Good morning. Welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. We're glad to have you with us. In just a little bit here, we'll be talking with Amy Stewart. She is a nature writer, and we will be talking about a book that she's authored. Actually, a book that was published a number of years ago and has recently been reissued. And the title of the book is The Earth Moved on the Remarkable Achievements of Earthworms. And we'll be talking about worms and their contribution to the natural environment, something that gardeners certainly should understand. Maybe not everybody does, but gardener should, and we'll talk about that in just a moment. I'm also very happy to have here in the studio with me Molly Delaney. She's our education outreach director, someone who works with teachers and goes out and does work in schools, and is not someone who you will hear on the air here, but is someone who is very important to the work we do at WILL and our involvement in the community. And I'm very happy that you're here.
I'm always happy to be there, or to be here. And that is what I do here at the station. But this morning, I'm here in a different capacity. I'm here as a Focus fan and as a gardener. So I can't wait to hear about earthworms. And we've just been kind of talking during this drive a lot about, April is when we're celebrating the 90th anniversary of the station. And when I think about that, when I have a little sheet here that tells me it started as a single vacuum tube radio station on April 6, 1922. I don't even know what single vacuum tube radio station means exactly, but 1922 was a long time ago. And I think about what that means in terms of the scope of my life and my family's life and how much WILL has meant to me. I'm a native of Central Illinois, so grew up listening to WILL, went to college at the U of I, and remember hearing Roger on the air and Roger Cooper. And so this station means a lot to me. If this station means a lot to you, we'd like to hear from you during this pledge drive. Help us celebrate our 90th anniversary with that donation of support. If you've never been a supporter before, we'd like to welcome you to our ranks, and we'd like you to make that call today at 244-9455 or by going to willpledge.org.
Okay. One thing I can tell you about that single vacuum tube business is that that meant that the transmitter just had this one tube, and when the tube got hot, if it got too hot, they just turned the radio station off.
Ah.
It's not completely go off the air. So the tube did not burn out. So that was a long time ago in terms of technology.
An interesting detail, yeah. All yeah, right. Imagine.
Well, we hope that people will take the opportunity to support us this morning. If you appreciate Focus and other shows that you hear on the station, we'll be here today and tomorrow, and that's it. And we're trying very hard to hear from as many people as we possibly can. We'll give you some other opportunities to do that.
Right.
Thank you very much. We're talking this morning in this part of the show with Amy Stewart, and we'll be talking about her book, The Earth Moved on the Remarkable Achievements of Earthworms. It's published in paperback. It's published by Algonquin Books, in which she notes that Charles Darwin, of all people, was fascinated by earthworms. In fact, he wrote that few animals had played such an important part in the history of the world. And before that, few scientists really thought that earthworms were worth thinking about or studying. However, Amy Stewart says that Darwin knew that worms were capable of much more than most scientists gave them credit for. And we'll explore some of that this morning in this hour of the show. We'll be very happy to take questions from people who are listening. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. Amy Stewart is the best-selling author of 5 books on the natural world. Her books include, the most recent is Wicked Bugs, The Louse That Conquered Napoleon's Army and Other Diabolical Insects, and before that, Wicked Plants, The Weed That Killed Lincoln's Mother and Other Botanical Atrocities. And all of these books are published by Algonquin. Amy Stewart, hello.
Hi there.
Hey, thanks for talking with us today.
Oh, my pleasure.
I appreciate it. I expect that it shouldn't really be surprising that somebody who is a nature writer and is interested in gardening, as you are, should be interested in earthworms. But having said all that, was there some particular thing that now some years back got you so interested that you decided that this would be an entire book?
Yeah, well, there was a thing that happened in my own life, which is that I moved from Santa Cruz, California, where I was a renter, to Eureka, California, very far northern California, almost into Oregon, where I bought a house. So I was able to garden in a much more serious way once I had my own place. And one of the things that I noticed as I was digging in the dirt at my new place is that the earthworms were different. There were clearly different species of worms, some that were larger, some that were much grayer in color than what I had seen in Santa Cruz. And so that made me wonder for the first time, how many different species of earthworms are there in the world, and what do we know about them? All I knew is that there were certain worms that could live in a compost bin and certain worms that couldn't. They lived in the ground, but I had never really thought much more beyond that. And when I went to the library to do a little digging, what I found was Charles Darwin's book on the formation of vegetable mold, which was his last book, but probably the first book ever to be published specifically on earthworms. And I was amazed at how much he had learned, but also how much we still haven't figured out since his day.
Mm-hmm. Well, when digging in my yard, and if I see them, I know that they're doing something good. So I would not molest them. I would be nice to them because I know it's a good thing for them to be there. But at the same time, I guess I didn't really know exactly what it was that they were doing that was good.
Yeah, well, and you know, that is a lot of what people are still trying to figure out. So what Darwin determined is that they were essentially creating the earth, making soil, breaking down organic matter into smaller bits. And interestingly enough, he also realized that they helped to bury archaeological ruins. He actually went out to Stonehenge and examined the extent to which earthworms had helped to bury Stonehenge. But what we know now, I mean, what modern science has taught us is that earthworms increase the porosity of soil so that oxygen and water can get to plant roots. We know that they feed on fungus and bacteria. That's what they eat. They don't actually eat leaves or grass clippings. They actually eat the bacteria and fungi that are feeding on them. And as a result, they change the composition of the soil. They change what specific species of microbes live in the soil, and that can have a profound effect on plant growth.
Mm-hmm. That's, I guess I probably did know, or I would have said, yes, I understood that. Aeration was mm-hmm. something that they did because they're tunneling through the soil,
right,
but
right.
They didn't really appreciate so much that this the process of the soil going through them, you know, going in one end and out the other, which it does, that actually changes the composition of the soil in terms of the microorganisms that are in there.
Yeah, even nematodes. You know, we hear about nematodes in our lawns, and like everything else in nature, some of them are good and some not so good, depending on the plants you're trying to grow. And they even change the population of nematodes in the soil because they devour some and actually digest them as their food source, and others actually thrive in the gut of an earthworm so that basically more come out the other end than went in the first place. Mm-hmm. So they really do transform the soil.
So then the soil that passes through them, the inert stuff, they don't really do anything. Do they do anything to it, or does it just pass through?
Well, when you think about what soil is, I mean, let's talk about what it's made of. It's particles of clay, particles of sand, and those are pretty much unchanged as they move through a worm. There's air and water in soil. There's decaying organic matter, and then there's living creatures. There's billions and billions. You know, one handful of soil contains billions of living creatures. So they do break down organic matter a little bit. I actually went and visited an earthworm scientist in Iowa named Sam James, who had done a little research years ago about whether or not plant matter actually gets broken down as it moves through the body of a worm. It's something that, strangely enough, scientists don't know that much about. And when I asked him, he said, oh, I did some research on that years ago. And he dug through his files and said, you know, I sliced open the body of an earthworm and put a little cellulose there, a little plant matter, and I did see that it got broken down some. So they do a little bit of that, but mostly what they're feeding on are these other microbes. They're sort of the larger animal eating the smaller animals, if you want to think about it that way.
So do they end up removing something that would be undesirable, or do they somehow modify things that end up making them more desirable?
In some cases, they actually will remove something that might be undesirable. Now, what makes this even more complicated, and maybe the reason why we don't really know much about earthworms, is that every species of earthworm might be different in this regard. So we can't even speak broadly about what earthworms do because Icynia foetida might be different than Aporectidea calignosa. So there's really a difference there. But what we do know for certain that they do is that they do destroy certain microorganisms. So they can actually prevent or eliminate some plant diseases because, as you know, plant diseases are caused by a bacteria or a fungus.
Mm-hmm. Our guest in this hour of focus is Amy Stewart. She's a nature writer and has written this book that she wrote, actually published a number of years ago and has been reissued now by Algonquin. It's in paperback. The title of her book is The Earth Moved on the Remarkable Achievements of Earthworms. And it talks about earthworms and their lives and what it is that they do for the soil. And if you're a gardener, if you're interested in nature, I think that you would enjoy reading it. Questions are welcome, too. If somebody wants to call in, tell us an earthworm story, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We also have email, which is will-talk@illinois.edu. I just am curious. I want to go back to Darwin, because this, you mentioned that this book that he wrote about earthworms came at the end of his life. I think that it was published just a year before he died, and that he was interested in soil formation, essentially how the dirt, how where it came from, how it was formed, and that got him interested in worms. Though what of all of the things that he might have written about after all of the writing that he did about natural selection and so forth, what got him interested in this particular subject?
Well, you know, he had actually been interested in earthworms for most of his life. It was something that he was always curious about. He just sort of never got around to it. For years, he had been conducting these kind of long-term experiments in his own lawn to track the progress that earthworms made. He examined the way they formed burrows in the lawn. He did all kinds of crazy tests. It's actually a very funny book to read. He's a surprisingly good writer. If you've never read any of Darwin's books, he's a really good writer. And this one's pretty comical because he's doing things like taking little paper triangles that he cut up himself and setting them out next to earthworm burrows in his lawn to test how earthworms go about figuring out the most efficient way to pull an unfamiliar object into their burrow. He knew they could pull leaves and grass in, but he thought, well, that could be instinctive. They've been doing it for millions of years. But what about something they've never encountered before? In other words, are earthworms capable of problem solving? can they think? And he actually demonstrated that they could. He did hundreds of these experiments and showed that they actually were able to, through trial and error, figure out the most efficient way to grab a little piece of paper and pull it into a burrow. So this was something he'd been working on for a while, and I think that given his age and his poor health, this was something he could do that didn't require him to leave the house much.
And did other scientists think that he was wasting his time with this?
Oh, I doubt it. I've never read anything to indicate that. It really did come out in the last year of his life, so I don't know that there was much time for anyone to react that way during his lifetime. Yeah. I mean, you know, he acknowledged that earthworms are a somewhat obscure subject and that people might not think that they were capable of much, and he set out to prove otherwise. But it is true that no one really picked up on his work and carried it forward. There was not any real serious earthworm research done for quite some time after Darwin's book.
Well, I think that one of the things that he did he not make try to make some kind of calculation of, in a representative volume of soil, how many worms there could be? And people thought, well, no, that couldn't possibly be. And it turned out that his estimate was significantly low.
Yeah, definitely. You know, this is something that, actually anyone can do. You can go out in your backyard and dig up roughly a cubic foot full of soil and sit there and sift through it and count the number of living creatures you run across. You'll sort of be amazed, but he did that to calculate the number of earthworms that could be found in an acre of land. And, the numbers turn out to be much higher in very, very healthy, say, pasture land. There can be millions of worms in an acre.
Our guest in this part of Focus is Amy Stewart, and we're talking about her book, The Earth Moved. We'll talk some more in just a second. We do need to take the opportunity here to encourage people to support the station. Molly Delaney's here in the studio with me. Now, I'm sure that you've come up with some very clever way to get asking for support and earthworms together. I just know you've done this. You've been sitting here thinking about that, haven't you?
Well, no, actually, I've been just absorbing this information today because I'm fascinated by worms, and I'm always very excited to find them in my garden. And I guess I never even realized until this morning that there, I mean, it makes sense that there's, you know, so many different species. And who knew that they could eliminate different kinds of plant diseases? That's just amazing to me. So no, I have not. I'm not punny this morning, I guess. however, I'm just learning a lot, which I think is the reason, you know, that makes the case why people should call in with their pledge of support. You know, if you're out there and you're listening and you're learning, we've been doing this for a number of years, you know, 30 years for Focus, which is pretty extraordinary. And it's still interesting. I mean, I'm just sitting here this morning. Wow, who knew earthworms could be so fascinating? But David makes it so. And also thanks to our guest, Amy, because this is a great conversation. We do need to hear from you, though. So that is why I'm here, not just to learn about earthworms. But, you know, if you've been a part of this community as long as I have and you appreciate this program, it really is the time when we need to hear from you with that pledge of support. So, again, let us know, 244-9455. You know, it can be any amount you choose, $1 a week, $2 a week, $10 a week, whatever you are able to contribute, we appreciate.
Yeah, and we really do need to get across just how vital listener support is. 40%, more than 40% of the money that it takes to run the station comes from listeners. So that's why we periodically do this, and we sit here and we invite people to support the station. It's the best way we have of getting the message out. There are some people who have gotten the message and have been with us year after year, but we continue to need to remind other folks, hey, we need you to.
Okay, get ready for the bad metaphor.
Okay, here we go.
There's millions of earthworms in an acre. We know that there's thousands of people out listening to Focus right now. So we need, you know, part of that earthworm population of listeners to call in their pledge of support.
We need you
really
to
bad.
Dig deep. Dig deep.
Oh,
into your wallet and make a contribution. Okay. 244-9455 is the number to call, or you can go online, willpledge.org. And our guest in this hour of Focus is Amy Stewart. Her book is The Earth Moved. It's all about the remarkable achievements of earthworms. And questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And just let me ask you, get back, Amy, to this the subject of the great variety of worms. And again, as I dig in my garden, I think, well, there's two kinds. There's big ones and there's little ones.
Right.
I'm sort of aware that they come in two sizes, but in fact, there are more than 4,500 species, different species of earthworm?
Yes, that we know of. And there's probably many more that we don't know of. You know, one of the things that really surprised me about earthworm science is there's still a lot of exploring left to do. If you think about it, if you're an ornithologist and you want to study birds, you kind of just have to look up. I mean, I don't want to oversimplify it, but they're there in the air. They are visible to us. If you want to explore space or even the sea, you can get to it in some way. But the thing about earthworms is they live in the earth, which we can't see through. No matter how good our binoculars are, we cannot see down into the earth. And they're very good at escaping shovels or tractors or probes. They don't want to be found, and they can feel you coming. They're very sensitive to vibrations. So earthworm scientists have a more difficult time even finding them, much less identifying them. And there's very few people working in earthworm science. You know, this is something I tell audiences all the time when I go out and speak about earthworms. I always say, you know, the economy's been kind of tough lately. A lot of people are looking at changing careers. If anybody wants to pursue a new career, earthworm science, oligocatology, the study of earthworms, is actually a wide open field. You're welcome to jump into it.
I'm noting that down. If you travel around the world, you go to different places around the world, you theoretically stick a shovel in the earth and turn over some dirt. Will you find earthworms everywhere?
Everywhere, no. And some of this is because of our geologic history. So, for instance, here in North America, a good deal of Canada and parts of North America, particularly around the Great Lakes region, were covered under glaciers during the last ice age 10,000 years ago. And when those glaciers receded, there were no earthworms left, and the forest that followed that ice age evolved without earthworms of any kind. So there are no native earthworms in those regions. You also won't find earthworms in the desert. They do need a certain amount of moisture. So there are some places around the world where it's either too hot or too cold or too dry for earthworms to live.
Let's talk about earthworm physiology a little bit, because in the simplest terms, as I would think about it, really what a worm is, it's like a tube in a tube. Say it's the digestive tract that the soil passes through, and then that's inside the worm. What more is there than that?
Well, they're surprisingly complicated little creatures. Depending on the species, most earthworms have several pairs of little hearts, so not a single heart. They do have something like a brain. You know, they have a cluster of nerves at the top of their head that serves as their brain. They have very interesting reproductive organs. Most species of earthworms are actually hermaphrodites, which means that they're both male and female, and mating basically just consists of kind of lining up belly to belly and making some sort of swap. But they are remarkably interesting creatures. You know, a good deal of what an earthworm was built to do is to survive being cut in half. People always ask me if, you know, can I cut an earthworm in half and get two worms? And the answer is no. A tail is not really capable of growing a new head. But a head is capable of growing a new tail. And you sort of wonder, how did earthworms get that capability and we didn't? You know, I lose an arm, it's gone forever. But an earthworm can regrow most of its body. It sort of makes you think, you know, I think maybe they might be a little more important than we are.
Well, how does that happen? And why, I suppose it seems natural, again, that it would be the head that part could regrow and not the tail, because the brain, I guess, do earthworms have brains?
They do. They do have this little cluster of nerves that serves as a brain.
Okay.
Yes. And, you know, part of the reason a tail can't grow a new head is that also the hearts, the multiple pairs of hearts that earthworms have, are located near the head. So when you have nothing but a tail left, you don't have much. You don't have a heart. You don't have a brain. It's not much to go on. But, yeah, you know, earthworms and starfish, two creatures that are capable of regeneration. And both are studied quite a bit for that ability. You know, scientists are always trying to figure out if there's anything we can learn from earthworms and starfish that we could apply to humans when it comes to growing new tissue.
Yeah. Before talking about earthworm sex, we should have made sure that people chased all the children from the room. I'm sure that I learned, and a lot of people would have learned at some point, that one of the things about earthworms that makes them special is that they have both male and female organs. But that doesn't mean that one worm can do it all alone, that you do have to have the exchange of genetic material for the understandable reasons of maintaining diversity in your gene pool. So that it does indeed take two. Just because they have both parts doesn't mean they can do it all by themselves.
That's right. It takes two, exactly. And, you know, you sort of wonder, how do they even find each other? I mean, you know, these are the kinds of things I was wondering about as I wrote the book. Like, you know, how does an earthworm find its soulmate? They're down there underground.
And they're blind.
They're blind. They can't see. They do have cells along their body. They have light-sensing cells in their skin that tells them if they're being exposed to light or not. So this is really important when you're trying to avoid a bird. So they have that capability. They're very sensitive to vibrations. They have a highly developed sense of moisture and also pH. They're very sensitive to pH in the soil. But how they use those things to find another earthworm so that they can fall in love and start a family, I don't know.
No, another one of those things. See, if we just had more earthworm scientists.
We do need more earthworm scientists.
We could study a question like that. Well, and then the other thing that I think is really fascinating that has to do with earthworm reproduction is what happens because the earthworms get together and they exchange genetic material, but then that material combines separate from the earthworms. So it's not quite like they lay an egg, but it's kind of like, I mean, that, as I think about it, that's kind of like what they do.
It is kind of like what they do, yeah. So this is very interesting. There is some exchange of sperm and egg. Basically what happens is that one earthworm or the other will receive the sperm and kind of just hold on to it. Fertilization does not happen immediately. They keep it in this this band of thickened flesh that's about one third of the way down the earthworm's body, called the clitellum. They sort of form a little it's like a cocoon that is held in. And then at some point, they wriggle out of that and leave a little capsule in the soil that's shaped like a lemon or a football. It's got that kind of oblong shape. And it's left in the soil. It holds both the sperm and the egg. And then fertilization happens later, whenever conditions are right. So this is how, you know, earthworms survive a very long cold winter or a long summer drought, is that they can remain in this state of suspended animation until it seems like a good time to come out again.
And then does one worm hatch from that, or do multiples hatch from that?
Multiple. Okay. Often it will be multiple.
Okay. Worms. And apparently they just look like big worms, only just little. The juveniles, they hatch essentially, aren't they're completely developed, they're just small.
That's right. They look exactly like their parents, only much smaller. So they don't go through the kind of multiple stages that insects go through, for example. In some ways, they're more like humans in that way. You know, their babies are just like them, only smaller.
Our guest this morning in this hour of Focus is Amy Stewart. We're talking about earthworms, and I'll bet that you're learning some stuff that you did not know. Questions also are welcome, 333-WILL and 800-222-WILL. We'll talk some more after a very short break. This is Focus.
WILL programs are made possible by Strawberry Fields Natural Food Store, offering more than 3,000 certified organic products, freshly baked breads, a coffee bar and bulk foods department, and an in-store nutritionist to answer questions about healthy eating. Strawberry Fields on Springfield Avenue in Urbana.
This is Focus. It's our morning talk show. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We are here weekday mornings from 10 until noon. We have 10 different topics every week. We try to mix it up, have a lot of different things on the show. In the second hour today, for example, we'll be talking with film critic Stefan Kanfer about his biography of Humphrey Bogart. The title of the book is Tough Without a Gun. And then tomorrow morning in the 11 o'clock hour, the guest is Bruce Hannon. He's an emeritus professor of geography at University of Illinois and is someone who is very interested in old clocks and has done, in fact, a lot of work repairing old clocks. For example, he was the guy who fixed the clock in the courthouse tower of the Champaign County Courthouse and has done work on some clocks around the campus. And we thought it might be interesting to have him come in and talk a little bit about that. So we'll talk about some of the old clocks that you will find around the campus and nearby. That's tomorrow at 11. We are here weekday mornings, 10 to noon. Go to the website, will.illinois.edu. You can check the schedule. You can also listen to past programs, and you can find us on Twitter at Will Public Media. We are also, in addition to getting excited about earthworms this morning, asking people to support the station with their dollars. It is a non-commercial, listener-supported station. Public broadcasting means that people who listen also support the station. And we are asking right now for people to do that. Molly Delaney is here in the studio with me. I relied on you to be a great romantic.
Yeah.
And the whole business of earthworm yeah. the thing, it's... You seem to be kind of overcome by the whole thing. Especially Earthworm Soulmate. That one's the one that got you.
That was the one that got me, yeah. And okay. Yeah, we're having trouble not giggling in the studio, but it's Monday morning, and you know, here we are talking about earthworm sex being reduced to the exchange of genetic material. So
this is public radio. This is public radio. I'm trying to be, you know, clinical about it.
Yes, yes. Well, okay. Clinical is always good. Clinical is always good. I have been handed a few notes, though, by our pledge producer, Heather Miller, that we need a variety of worms to get the job done. So I'm just going to say that we need a variety of listeners to support us to keep our financial soil healthy. So we need your genetic material to contribute to our gene pool today.
Now you're going too far.
Yeah, I know. and how about this? Every contribution you make is like it's put in the inside of an earthworm, and it regenerates itself myself and contributes back to the community. There, have I been bad enough? Are you ready to start talking again?
That's why I love you so much. Yes, in fact, that's good. So look, folks, we'll stop now for right here. The important thing is here, you support your station. If you enjoy listening to this kind of thing or anything else that we have on the station, it needs your support. The reason it's here is because folks like you support
and
it.
And we have had a call of support. We've already had one pledge this morning, but, you know, we need somebody else to belly up and add their genetic material, and we want to hear from you at 244-9455.
We're trying to worm our way into your affections, and
oh,
if that doesn't
bad.
Work, we'll dish some dirt later on. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Those are the numbers to call. Amy Stewart is our guest this morning. Her book is The Earth Moved. She is a nature writer. She's written 5 books about the natural world. Just to mention a couple of other titles, the most recent are Wicked Bugs and Wicked Plants. And this one, they're all published by Algonquin Books. And we have a caller here, and let's talk with them. Somebody in Kankakee calling us on a cell phone right here, line number 4. Hello.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question. I caught the first part of the program, but I was gone away for a couple minutes. But is it my impression or my I've heard that earthworms are some earthworms are not native. They're invasive species. Is that correct?
Well, that's a very interesting thing to talk about, actually. It is true that there are parts of this country that had no native worms at all, but
right.
Across most of North America, we do have native species of earthworms. However, the ones that you probably find in your backyard, like nightcrawlers, that's a European species. That's Lumbricus terrestris. And the ones that we all use in worm bins, if you do worm composting, or sometimes they'll just show up in your compost pile, without you inviting them, Lumbricus rubellus or Icinia petita, the red wigglers, those are also European species. They're not bad. They're not problematic. They do a lot of good. But there are certain ecosystems, not all, but certain ecosystems where they really have changed the characteristics of the soil, and as a result, native plants have had a hard time growing. The most famous case, and I wrote a chapter about this in the book, is in Minnesota. Minnesota's forests have been completely transformed by earthworms, and native plants just can't live in the soil. They're not used to it. It's much richer and lighter and just of a very different quality than what they had before these European earthworms showed up.
Okay, very good. Thank you very much for that information. I heard it was in Minnesota, too. But yes, thank you very much.
All right.
And,
sure.
Can I already am a member, but I will be happy to stay on the line and contribute again.
Well, you'll need to call a different number.
Okay, all right.
I would love for you to do that, but if you would call the 244-9455, that
okay,
would be great. Hey, thank you very much.
Right. Sure. Fine.
Well, this, Amy, I think this gets at an interesting point because I think that apparently there are some people who actually think that earthworms are pests and that they want to get rid of them. In fact, I think in the course of your being associated with writing about this topic, you've actually heard from people that said, oh, I have earthworms in my lawn and in my garden, and I want them to go away.
Right, which would be very self-defeating. You know, people who want to maintain a pristine lawn and people who manage a golf course might not want the little tiny burrows that nightcrawlers create. They might feel like that's, you know, sort of disrupting their very clean green landscape. But it's a sign of healthy soil. It's a sign of a healthy lawn. And these reports of earthworms, of European earthworms being invasive and being harmful, have really been overblown in the media. There's a limited number of ecosystems where that's the case. And they really do not destroy the plants themselves. They're not going to eat your plants. They're only interested in the soil. What they are going to do is just change the soil composition, which changes what plants can grow there. And even that is only the case in really just kind of these limited pockets, like I said, around the Great Lakes region, sort of the upper East Coast area in North America. And otherwise, they haven't been shown to have any negative effect on ecosystems elsewhere in North America that I know of.
Let's talk with someone else. This is someone here in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
Oh, hi. I have had questions for years about these earthworms, and I don't want this to reflect negatively on my housekeeping abilities, but I've been cleaning gutters, rain gutters, for years and years on single-story and double-story, your two-story houses. So after you begin to notice the tree sprouts and, you know, there's birds up there mining through the dirt and whatnot, when they get in that state, maybe several years gone without cleaning them, there are earthworms up in there.
Mm-hmm.
How do they get there?
Good question. Generally, the thought is that they're probably carried there by birds. In other words, birds might have dirt and bits of whatever's in the soil clinging to their claws. Or, you know, a bird might pick up a worm in its beak and for some reason not get around to eating it and it gets dropped. So it's probably something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, earthworms really are found in very unlikely places. Rain gutters are a good example, but also in the upper canopies of trees. I live in redwood country in Northern California, and people who study redwood trees in Humboldt County know that you get up there in the canopy, and not only is there a little sort of soil ecology and, you know, ferns and baby trees and other things sprouting way up high in the canopies of the trees, hundreds of feet above ground. But you will also find earthworms up there. So they, any place they can find their little ecological niche, they will, even at the top of a redwood tree and even in a rain gutter.
Oh, my gosh. Okay. Well, thank you.
All right. Sure. Thank you. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. You can also send us email, will-talk, that's willtalk at illinois.edu. Well, we know that birds will eat worms. Are they a significant food source for anything? I mean, is that part of what they do in the environment, or is there just so many of them that doesn't really, that's not really a factor?
Oh, well, they're absolutely a significant food source for birds. In fact, you know, one interesting thing I don't think people think about anymore, but when Silent Spring was published, you know, Rachel Carson's book that examined the effects that DDT was having in our environment, she made a very interesting point, which is that where the DDT was being concentrated was in the bodies of earthworms. Earthworms have a remarkable ability to take up a good deal of poison and survive. Again, it's sort of interesting that they're equipped with such powerful survival skills. They can accumulate a lot of heavy metals in their body, and they can accumulate pretty nasty poisons like DDT. So the birds that were being sickened by DDT, that was in large part because it was being sprayed on the trees. And when those leaves drop to the ground, they're eaten by earthworms who survive the poisoning. And then when a robin eats just 10 or so earthworms, that's enough DDT to kill them. So it shows you how important they are to the diets of birds, that this was the mechanism by which birds were being poisoned by DDT.
That's amazing. Well, let's go. We have another caller here, somebody in Savoy. Let's talk with them. Line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Fascinating subject. I've got lots of worms in my yard, which I always thought was good, but I've been told by lawn care professionals that I also have an infestation of grubs, which have eaten the roots of grass and other plants, which I want to keep in the lawn. My question is, if I put something on the lawn to get rid of the grubs, will that have a harmful effect on the worms?
Yes. If you use a chemical, you know, a pesticide that's designed to kill a soft-bodied creature like a grub or a caterpillar or a nematode, it absolutely will kill the worms. It will devastate them. You can probably find an organic or a natural treatment to use. For instance, you can actually buy a particular species of nematode to kill a particular kind of grub. So if you know what you've got, if you know what kind of creature it is.
That's beyond my poor powers of gardening, unfortunately.
Yes. Well, it might be that whoever's telling you that the grubs are a problem can dig one up and either identify it, or you could go to your local master gardeners group or your local county agricultural office
They could tell you what you've got.
Capture one of these grubs and take it in for identification. Is that what you're suggesting?
Yeah, it can be done.
Yeah, I think all you have to do is I know we've talked about this with some of our folks here who talk about insect control, is if you just make a little slit in the soil, you should be able to just roll it back like you're rolling up a carpet. And if there are grubs under there, that's one of the ways you decide, do you have enough grubs to treat? You count how many in a square foot you've got. So it's actually not that hard. And then I'm sure, yeah, if you took it to the local extension folks, they could tell you what it was.
So I could get some sort of natural predator which would attack those nematodes but leave the earthworms alone.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, you could find out about a natural predator, which would be some sort of probably little microscopic nematode. You get them in a little package and you soak them in a bucket of water and spray them on. There might be also some cultural thing you could do. Sometimes it turns out that the soil is, you know, too wet or too dry or too this or too that, and there's some practice that you can change that would improve it. But ultimately, I would say, you know, is it really affecting your life that much?
There are huge bare spots where nothing now grows, and I have been told these are by commercial companies that what's happened is that there are grubs there that have eaten all the roots of the plants.
Sometimes there's other species of grass or other varieties of grass too that are a little bit more resistant. So that might be an option.
Okay. All right. Thanks very much.
All right. Thank you. We have maybe about 5-6 minutes left in this part of Focus, talking with Amy Stewart. Her book is The Earth Moved, On the Remarkable Achievements of Earthworms, and it's published by Algonquin Books. It's in paperback and tells you everything that you need to know about earthworms. And if you're interested in nature, you're interested in gardening, you might want to take a look at the book. Questions are welcome, too. We can get in, I'm sure, one or two if somebody really calls right now. 333-9455 and a toll-free 800-222-9455. You know, one of the things that I wanted to ask you about that was kind of tickled me was that you have written about all the stuff that since this book was published that people who read it sent you because somehow you and worms were associated in their mind, and they sent you all kinds of strange stuff.
You know, I'm afraid if we talk about this too much,
they'll send you more stuff. Oh, I'm sorry. I would not want that to happen.
You would be amazed at the amount of earthworm poetry, artworks, whether it's paintings or drawings, little board games. I received somebody invented an earthworm-themed board game and sent a copy to me to try out. Yes, over the years, I have received an astonishing number of tributes, handmade tributes to the powers and wonders of earthworms, and they continue to come all these years later.
I think that actually also people sent you earthworms for identification. They sent you a worm and said, can you tell me what this is?
Well, you know, I've never received an actual worm. I have received many, many photographs of worms.
Oh, okay.
Asking
okay.
What they are. Fortunately, no one has ever actually put a worm in an envelope and mailed it to me.
Oh, okay. Well, good. That's the one you want to put hand cancel on there.
Right.
We had a caller. They gave up. They want to try again, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Anything else that you really, on the list of amazing stuff that even you learned while you were doing the research for this book?
Yeah, you know, I was surprised to learn that earthworms are capable of devouring half of our waste stream, at least half of our waste stream. They can eat all of our food waste. They can eat paper, any sort of pulp, textiles, anything that's fabric. They can eat all of our yard waste, of course, and then things like brewery waste, food processing plants, and manure, you know, all kinds of animal manure. So try to imagine half of our waste stream being devoured by earthworms and turned into really a pretty powerful soil amendment. It's something that's being done more and more, and in fact, I visited a sewer treatment plant that's using earthworms to digest, let's just say, the biosolids, what some people call sewage sludge, what treatment plants prefer to call biosolids. But devouring that and processing it, it's even a process that the EPA has approved of because they are so effective at essentially cleaning it and turning it into a fairly harmless, innocuous form of organic matter that you can grow plants in.
Well, I would say that's really interesting because I know that there are people in their home composting operations employ earthworms and use them to do their thing, because as they do that, and though I was wondering whether anybody on a commercial scale, say, or larger than a backyard gardener was trying to do things like that.
Oh, lots and lots. Yeah, there are many big cities have programs to gather up green waste from restaurants, or just the yard waste that we put out in our green waste bins, and to feed those to worms and create a pretty high-value product at the end of it. You know, it's something that's really useful. You think about what's happening on our farms. You know, we hear all these stories about how the soil's being depleted, we're overusing chemicals, we're really hurting the earth. And then at the same time, there are big disposal problems, for instance, on feedlots, getting rid of animal waste. Well, you put those two things together and you realize we could take all the waste stream that's coming off of farms and feedlots, we could feed that to earthworms, and we could use that as a fertilizer in soils instead of some of the chemicals we're using. So there really is this nice kind of full circle appeal to using earthworms more in our waste stream, and I hope we'll see more of that.
Yeah. Well, if folks are composting at home, I'm sure that there are probably some worms that are finding their way in there by themselves. But are there ways that people deliberately in the design, either the way that they're doing it or the kind of stuff that they use to do it, to contain things like both yard waste and kitchen scraps, the things that can be composted, that you, in an intentional way, get worms in there for them to do their thing?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, I will, I have a worm bin. There's all these sort of very fancy little, they're sort of like worm condos, you know, the worm factory, the worm, the can of worms. There's all these fancy worm bins that you can buy to put your kitchen scraps in, and the worms live very happily in there, and then you sort of separate out the worms from the castings and use those in your garden. And even for ordinary compost bins, you're right, they will just find their way in. They don't really need a lot of help. If you've got an active compost operation going, earthworms will find their way there.
Well, this, and you know, I mentioned a couple of your more recent books, the words of the ones about the deadly bugs and the deadly plants, and this this book, the earthworm book, is actually was something that you first published about 6 years ago, maybe?
2004, something like that, yeah.
And that has been reissued by your publisher that has published your other books.
Mm-hmm.
So this is in the vein of things that you're interested in. What are you working on now?
You know, I actually just finished my new book. It won't be out till next year. It's just in copy editing right now. But it's called The Drunken Botanist, and it's about all the plants that we make into alcohol in one way or another.
Mm-hmm.
So the research for that one, as you can imagine, was very fun. I didn't get a lot of volunteers to help with my earthworm research, but when I told people I was writing a book about booze, I got lots of offers.
They were lining up, I'm sure. Well, are there, we know about fruit that's fermented to make alcoholic beverages, and there are a lot of grains that you can use to do that. And then there's,
yes,
I guess, a particular cactus that some people like to...
Of course, agave and tequila. Right.
Are there other things that other than those that write for me come to mind that people apply to that kind of production?
Well, you know, sugar cane.
Oh, of course,
and
rum, yeah.
Right, rum. And actually, tree sap, there's a lot of interesting alcohol made from the sugar of, say, palm trees or coconut trees, not the coconuts themselves, but the sugary sap. Corn even has been used not just to make bourbon, which is what we think of with booze and corn, but even the stalks of corn. There are certain varieties of corn that have very sweet stalks, and you can crush the stalks and get a sugar out of that and make booze out of that. Really, you know what? If it grows out of the ground and it either produces sugar in the form of fruit or, you know, straight sugar, or it's a grain where the starch can be converted into sugar, if there's sugar in it anywhere, someone has figured out a way to make alcohol from that.
It's one of the oldest human occupations. I suppose it goes hand in hand with baking bread, brewing.
Yes, it absolutely does. It was pretty much our first order of business, was to make ourselves a nice drink.
All right. Well, with that, we will leave it with the recommendation that if you'd like to read more on the subject of earthworms, you look for the book The Earth Moved, on the remarkable achievements of earthworms by our guest, Amy Stewart. It's published in paperback by Algonquin. And you might also want to take a look at some of her other books. The two most recent ones are Wicked Plants and Wicked Bugs. And Amy, thank you very much for talking with us today.
All right. Thank you.